Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Truth of Happiness Dhamma Study Sangha discussion on the five clinging aggregates and Dhamma talk that introduces a ninth week study of karma and rebirth. This was recorded on February 14th, 2017 at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace.
So last week we studied the second half of the chapter on understanding not self, understanding anatta. And so I'd like to hear if you see how that developing an understanding of the five clinging aggregates helps to develop that profound understanding of dukkha and individual contributions to craving for and clinging to objects, events, and views. So we'll start with Matt. See you tonight, my friend.
John, to see everybody. Good class last week, and this reading was good as well. So developing that profound understanding. Not self or anatta, and looking at the five clinging aggregates, is that, or I guess developing that profound understanding of suffering, of dukkha, through understanding the five clinging aggregates is like the five clinging aggregates aren't describing a self, they're describing how we fabricate a self and establish it and set it up to cling and crave and wander in delusion. Yeah. So I think that the five clinging aggregates is a way to see how ignorance of Four Noble Truths creates something that suffers.
Yeah, exactly. That the fabrications are assumptions. The Buddha's using this concept of five clinging aggregates to explain how from that ignorance we create a confusion in our mind and assume that from clinging these disparate objects together, now there's a self, and there must be a self. Form, feelings, perceptions, mental fabrications, and consciousness rooted in ignorance. And it's in our minds that we cling these together. And really, the five clinging aggregates are the essence of clinging. When the Buddha describes an awakened human being, he describes that human being as released or released from clinging or having abandoned clinging. So when we let go of clinging, we're no longer using these disparate objects as a clung together. The word that's often used in Pali and Sanskrit is khanda or skanda. And that means a big heap. Sometimes it can also be translated to mean a trunk of a tree. But if you think about this big heap that we create in our own minds from ignorance, and we say, well, this big heap is me. And we try to use that to establish a permanent self. And there, that's the problem. You can't. Nothing can be permanent in an impermanent world. So, thank you. Kevin, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you, John. Good to see you, everybody. You pretty much took what I was going to say.
Right? I'm sorry.
I was going to say, well, this five clinging aggregates for me have always been rather difficult to comprehend on their own. I feel that, you know, understanding dependent origination and understanding where we sort of insert these wrong views, how the five clinging aggregates, you know, sort of manifested. And, you know, what you were saying about emptying or going forth or releasing these wrong views or these hardened views, essentially leaves these just aggregates. There's nothing left. If you're emptying yourself of clinging, then they're just, you know, sort of these filters or reference points, as we said. So I clearly understand that, and that's what I was going to say. If you're emptying the views, releasing all those, then I kind of just like, oh yeah, why clinging aggregates? Like, it's just, I'm already on, I want to go to the next lesson, you know? I mean, I get it and I understand it, but I feel that from in my study and my practice, understanding dependent origination has sort of, you know, skipped that, I understand the fogging aggregates much more profoundly by focusing on that, if that makes any sense.
So. Oh, it does. Yeah, and you're so right. You can't, the five clinging aggregates are completely nonsensical unless they're taken in the, or seen in the right context. And following an understanding of dependent origination then allows an understanding of the five clinging aggregates and how it fits into the teaching. So, and it has to be seen for what it is. It's too easy. A self-referential ego personality wants to even take things in the Dhamma and create an identity over it. And that's the difficulty with understanding the five clinging aggregates, because we want to create an identity over something that the teaching says, look, this, you can create an identity over it, but you can confuse yourself by doing so. And so we start trying to apply our views rather than the right context to see it in. When you look at it in the right context, it just makes sense. And it's not something to take too seriously either. You know, it's just, it's an important teaching, but it's almost an offhanded teaching. Like, you know, this is what you did, you know. That's all. It's all you need to know. This is what you did. And let it go. Thank you. Stefan, good to see you tonight.
I'm good to see you too. Right now I'm feeling that I've been out for a week. I don't think I have anything for this conversation.
Well, I'm glad you're here. Do you see how it fits in with the overall context of, in fact, do you see how it fits in with the overall context of suffering, a misunderstanding of self?
Yes, I think so. Right. I also think that this is one of the harder bits for me to make sense of.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't feel like I have any helpful comments.
I'm glad you're. Many people feel that way. It can be very, very difficult, because it really is. It's like looking at a mirror that's obscured in some way. The glass isn't quite right, or the backing is missing, and you can't really see what's there. But it's because the five clinging aggregates are so close to us. You know, it really does describe us. But our view has to be really rooted in right view to see it correctly. And when I was putting the book together and even thinking about teaching the class, now let me go back. When I was putting the book together, it took me a while to decide, yeah, I really need to include this, simply because I felt that everybody that reads it is going to be confused by it, because it doesn't make a whole lot of sense until you've had a pretty well-developed understanding of everything that the Buddha was teaching. But it's important, like everything else. The first time we come across dependent origination, it's okay, maybe, you know, I can kind of see how it fits. But it doesn't have any real meaning until we start applying it to our life. So the five clinging aggregates are like that too. As we start to deepen our understanding of who we are in relation to this impermanent world, as we start to understand the three marks of existence, then we can start seeing the impermanence of each of these five skandhas, five clinging aggregates, and recognize the impermanence of each one. And that's really the key to it, to understand that these five things that we cling together to say, this is me, each and every one of the components is impermanent. And if it's impermanent, as the Buddha says, if it's impermanent, it's prone to suffering. If it's prone to suffering, it can't be me. We can't use it to describe a self. Yet we do. So that's why the teachings are here. That's why the Buddha taught it. Ron, good to see you tonight.
I was musing along before and looking at this little sign that you set up of the five clinging aggregates. And something's been kind of bugging me for a while yet as to how feelings, as you say often, establish this not-self. And then I realized, well, I do get it as far as the consciousness and the fabrications and even the perceptions. I get how they establish self pretty clearly. And I'm still working on the feeling and form part, how that what function that has in establishing the self, the non-self.
That's a great question. You could not have perceptions, assumptions, or an ongoing consciousness rooted in ignorance without a form giving rise to feelings first.
Right.
In other words, there'd be nothing for the rest of the process.
Mm-hmm.
So this physical form that we'd like to identify as ourselves, and even though we know in a general sense that this physical body is impermanent, we're distracted from that, and we're mm-hmm. confused from that point, and we decide that this physical self is me, and it's
yeah.
a permanent me.
Actually, even that part I get. Yeah, I get
the feeling.
You know, I'm hung in the feelings.
The feeling is, in fact, Stefan, you questioned this a couple weeks ago too, I think. A feeling in this sense is not necessarily an emotional feeling or a physical feeling. It's more to be looked at as a movement of the mind or an agitated mind. Something has impacted the form and caused the mind to move, to become agitated in some way.
As a reaction.
And because the reference of that is rooted in ignorance, it gives rise to false perceptions, which gives rise to false assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you can see how we're starting to form something that seems solid when it's all impermanent. It's like the Buddha says, foam on the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And that last process then is that ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance, that consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And now that we've, in this process, it's not something that we can easily observe. It happens in an instant. You know, we don't go through a long, drawn-out process where we can say, okay, now I see where I'm a form, and now I see feeling, unless you get really well concentrated. It's just a description of the process that occurs that continues ongoing ignorance. Remember how it relates back to dependent origination. Ignorance through 12 observable causative links causes all manner of suffering. This is the vehicle that experiences those links. But all of it is rooted in ignorance. And again, what is rooted in ignorance can only lead to more ignorance. So it's not something that we should... The other aspect of a self-referential ego self is the need to analyze everything.
Mm.
And that's just another way of keeping yourself distracted. And we do this certainly with five clinging aggregates because at first glance we don't understand it. And then we want to pick it apart too much instead of see it on its surface.
Mm.
And just recognize that that's a process that's ongoing. So that is something. Using feelings as a second clinging aggregate can be confusing because we look at feelings mostly as emotional or physical feelings.
It gets a little clearer to me when it's about things that I kind of obsess about. Then all of a sudden it starts to get a little kernel of, now I can see it's happening.
In this sense, that's somewhat of a feeling, but that's really more of what followed from a feeling. That's a perception.
Mm-hmm.
But again, they're so closely related. It there's no benefit in saying, okay, here's where feeling ends and this is where perception begins.
Boundaries.
Just see it as an ongoing process that mm-hmm. continues. It's necessary to continue the aggregates if we're going to continue confusion, delusion, and suffering. Another way of saying that is once we recognize what we're doing, and abandon clinging, we still have a human life in a form that has feelings that may give rise to perceptions. Probably not the assumptions because we're now an awakened human being. And that consciousness will be rooted in wisdom now. So what was once a hump, a heap, a stump of a tree that we use to describe ourselves is now unbound. And so we're simply in the process of life occurring without anything to react to that life. Does that make sense to everyone?
Mm-hmm.
Matt?
So can we see form in the context of the five clinging aggregates as, you know, nama rupa or name and form as the sixth sense base or as the platform for the sixth sense base, which is experiencing
contact.
Right. What's making contact? Name and form is making contact.
Yeah.
What's feeling something? Name and form is feeling something based on phenomena arising and passing away
in this within the sixth sense base.
Yes, and that's exactly how to see it in relation to dependent origination, which explains the nature of suffering. This is simply, the five clinging aggregates are simply the vehicle that we are using to experience that process of from ignorance, all manner of suffering arises. So again, it's somewhat circular now that I said that, but it's not discursive. In other words, it's not turning our minds back on itself. But you can pick any part of dependent origination, such as name and form, understand that, and let that idea go. Stop clinging to the idea of name and form. Name and form, nama rupa, simply means that I am identifying myself as this form. That's a very simple explanation of it. This is John. This is me. Name attached to the form. When you really understand that and let that go, release yourself from clinging to that idea, the five clinging aggregates fall apart. Dependent origination falls apart, meaning that the links are unbound from each other. And there's no longer the process in place to carry you from ignorance to suffering. Another, and you can do that with any link in that. When you recognize that craving and clinging are a requisite condition, and you let go of craving and clinging, again, how the Buddha described an awakened human being, free from clinging, free from craving. You don't want anything. The whole process falls apart, but it's not like we fall apart. We're just simply letting go of ignorant views. Again, it's like foam on the ocean, but because we have such a strong identity, and that describes clinging, doesn't it? We're creating an identity by clinging these disparate objects, aggregates together, and using them to say, look, this is me. This proves that I'm a self. I have a form. I just had a feeling. I have a place in the world now. And that feeling has created a perception. And it's a self-referential perception, isn't it? A discursive perception. And because of that perception, we start creating assumptions. And those assumptions or fabrications are what we think we need in order to survive in the world, to be happy. And we start clinging after objects, events, and ideas and views to fulfill that need. It's the need that's an illusion. It's the need that is unnecessary. Is that clear? It's only a self-referential ego self that creates a constant need for self-referential views and self-referential objects to have into its life. And it's just another simple way of saying the five clinging aggregates. And I think I'm probably confusing this more than helping, but thank you, Matt. Casey, good to see you tonight.
See you too, John.
How are things going?
They're going well.
Meditation practice is good?
No.
Well, you're in the right place then.
Yeah, I am.
Casey was with us on the last retreat, and he came in from Seattle tonight to come to this class to pick up his meditation practice.
Why not in the morning?
That, anything you'd like to add tonight?
The form and the feeling that to me, and perceptions and mental fabrications that clearly demonstrates to me that when we grasp at those and hold on to those things, that just further perpetuates the suffering. And that's clear to me to see. But it's a lot, it may be clear to see, but it's not as easy to sort of work through and understand. It's seeing it is one thing, but then separating the self or the perceived perception of self from that is a much more difficult thing.
It is, and that's where we need the entire Eightfold Path and the context in which to see it in. But if you can think about, if you can separate who you are just from your feelings, in other words, if you can have a strong feeling and a reaction in your mind without a further reaction, in other words, not needing it to be any different, and being present with what's occurring, then that doesn't lead to continued perceptions, assumptions, and ignorant consciousness flowing from it. You're just simply present with what's occurring. And what's that like? What is that like? You might have a feeling of sadness, but it's just a feeling of sadness. It doesn't need to be explained away. It doesn't need to be, we don't have to have aversion to any certain feeling. It's simply a consequence of living in the world. the profound understanding of dukkha occurs, the first noble truth, is yes, it does. As a consequence of having a human life, this is what the Buddha said. Dukkha occurs. We can't escape it, and we shouldn't try to. And that profound understanding then allows us to live our life as our life occurs without needing it to be any different than it is. And so when wonderful things happen, I just got an email from Keith, who's down in Florida. He was looking at a sunset, and he remembered my talk about the green flash. I won't get into that whole story. But he said that he kind of got this impermanence now by looking at it. So a beautiful, wonderful thing happens in our life. And rather than create an identity of it and then create a possible disappointment when the next sunset isn't quite as beautiful, we're simply present with the beautiful sunset. Or a beautiful baby. Or an angry boss. You know, we can have our boss screaming at us one day and we're done with it. We don't have to take it to the next day. I hope he's not yelling at me the next day. And we can take, and again, I'm using rather inane situations, but we do this all the time. If we can separate form from feeling, if we can abandon the need to cling these aggregates together, then we have awakened. There's no longer anything left in our minds to distract us or create a reaction in our mind. We're simply present with life as life occurs. There is dukkha. The Buddha never said that there is dukkha, but I can end it all. He simply promised that if you develop the Eightfold Path, you can end your individual contributions to stress and suffering. And you will no longer be bothered by the common causes and conditions of worldly human life. Meaning, when the Buddha described suffering, he said birth is suffering, sickness is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering. Not getting what is wanted is suffering. Getting what is undesired is suffering. And then he finished that every time by saying, in short, the five clinging aggregates are suffering. So in this context, I'll say, the five clinging aggregates are the vehicle for suffering. Shut down the vehicle and you don't no longer contribute to your own suffering. Getting to the heart of the matter, aren't we? Melanie, it's good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. Still being in the infant stages of all this and, progressing, I hesitate to speak sometimes because I talk in self. I don't know how to always form my thoughts in a way that kind of goes along with everything. But I can say this, looking at the five clinging aggregates and the way life has unfolded, how there's been a lot of time spent because people recognizing me as a overly sensitive person, I've spent a lot of time in the feelings and perception part, and just realizing how that is feeding into dukkha, I guess, and the stress of my life. It does seem like I understand more and more every time why all of this makes sense and why it would be what I would want to work towards, because instead of being in that cycle of the five clinging aggregates. Does that make any sense?
It makes perfect sense. What you're describing, and I'm kind of going against what modern Buddhism calls stream entering, but what you're describing is what is meant by stream entering. You're getting an understanding of the ramifications of the Dhamma and where it's going to take you, and that's so important. That's the beginning of developing understanding. You heard me use that whatever the right word for using it. If you're in New York and you want to go to Chicago, but you think you're in Los Angeles, you can't get there, you're getting an understanding of where you are. And that's going to allow you to continue with the rest of the path. That's exactly how this develops. So good for you.
Like there's all these puzzle pieces floating around in my head, all the different terminology, these different things. But it's really hard to form a thought about all of these different things that I'm learning all kind of at once.
You can't. At least only Kandana could. Kandana, there's a story about that. Maybe some people can. But it really is an ongoing process, and it requires the right framework. Again, that's why the Buddha taught, it's the only reason he taught an Eightfold Path, to overcome the common human problem of conditioned thinking. And as we deepen our understanding of the Eightfold Path, then we start seeing how everything fits together. But it's a gradual process. And it's rooted in deepening concentration. You know, the problem of anatta, of not self, is that in order for anatta to continue itself, its unskillful existence, requires constant distraction. When we start deepening our concentration, we are able to see exactly what we're doing to keep this thing going, to keep the aggregates alive. You know, but you're gaining that right perspective. So good for you. I'm glad you're here tonight. Helen, good to see you tonight. How are you?
One of the things that I'm thinking about as you're describing all of this is those images you see and you look at it, it's black and white. Is it two people facing each other or is it a vase? And when you take those parts away, it disappears. So I sort of feel like that's what the five clinging aggregates are. They're the negative space around you that forms that shape that you see of yourself, or that image you have of yourself. And that's how my mind works.
That's a great way of seeing it. And like that, when you take those objects away,
the image disappears.
The five clinging aggregates fall apart. That's beautiful. Thank you. Mary, good to see you tonight.
Oh, it's good to be here. I feel the same way, in that sometimes it's hard to find the words, that things make sense in your head, and it's sometimes hard to find the words to say what you're thinking. And this is so basic, but one of the things that has stayed with me is that you have to sustain ignorance in order to continue the suffering, right?
So, yep.
But like, to truly understand that sentence is, well, why would I do that? You know, to sustain ignorance. You wouldn't get up and intentionally do that if you were really concentrated and thinking about it. So I find that things that you've said many times, even foam on the ocean, you know, the more concentrated you get, the more those things start to make sense to you. This is great. This is great, the meat of it all, and I'm really experiencing it in a very deep way.
Thank you for saying that. The reason why the Buddha taught meditation is to deepen concentration, and you can see why when you understand why we need a well concentrated mind. You can't integrate any of this thing if you're continuing distraction, and a lot of meditation techniques tend to do that. You know, especially if you have the wrong focus, and the idea of the self-referential ego self must continue to ignore what is obvious. That's an aspect of ignorance. For ignorance to continue, we must ignore really what is right in front of us, our own contributions to suffering. But because we're not well concentrated, we can't see it. But like Melanie just described, as we just get into it a little bit, we start seeing the ramifications of what this is all about and where we're going. You know, and that's so important to recognize that, and then to maintain the framework of the Eightfold Path. Everything comes back to that. So, thank you. Will, I want to welcome Will to our Sangha tonight. Will just moved here, and it's good to see you. Welcome to our Sangha.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Yeah.
It's good to hear this.
Do you have any questions or comments on what you've heard so far? I know this is nothing new to you. So.
Well, it's just clarity. That's what it's bringing, to hear everybody's perspective. What I was feeling is how I my understanding of the aggregates is when I cling to them, that's the vehicle of my suffering.
Yes.
And just through, it's like the process of meditation. When I cling to it, when I'm aware of the thought, come back. You know.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way.
Yeah.
But
yeah, but thank you for saying that, because the meditation practice that we use directly addresses the problem of clinging, including clinging aggregates. Every time that we come back to the sensation of our breathing, we're caught up in our thoughts, and those thoughts are clinging. In fact, we're clinging one thought to another thought. So when people talk about this monkey mind, I have such a busy mind, it's because you're clinging your thoughts so quickly, so closely and quickly to the next thought. As we come back to the sensation of breathing, we're interrupting that process, that conditioned process. We're in a very direct way, we're unbinding our clinging thoughts and we're unbinding the clinging aggregates every time we do it. It has a direct relation to the overall goal of unbinding, as the Buddha taught. The meditation method within the proper framework has a direct relation to that process. Thank you for bringing that up. Lorna, good to see you tonight.
Thank you. Good to be here. I think towards the back of the book, the harder it gets. I think I like the front of the book better. Sneaked up on me, all of what this is. But I understand that the five clinging aggregates are the vehicle in which we create ourselves, I'm making. And I've always understood that, but this the whole chapter, what we've read about in the chapter, has rather surprised me. I look upon the problem of eye making. I think sometimes I have the view, the long-term feeling, the long-term view, that if I wasn't so caught up in eye making and I could just relax those thoughts, then a whole lot of dukkha and stress would just vanish.
Yep.
And I think that's the way I've looked at this problem in the past, that just abandon the eye making when I have strong referential views about myself, I'm not following the Dharma, and just don't take myself so seriously. The overall pattern of the chapter was familiar, but the details of the wording and the sentences were not familiar to me, like there have been in other chapters. I think you slipped this chapter in somewhere and not told anybody. Slipped it in the book and so that's my take on it.
Thank you. You're just developing the proper context to see it. And for most of us it takes quite a bit of, maybe your third or fourth or fifth or sixth time through the book.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a lot of repetition. It takes a lot of developing the right view so we can see how this applies. And you're absolutely right. The five clinging aggregates are all about eye making. Lauren and I had a little email about eye making today. Would you like to talk about you? And I know I'm kind of putting you on the spot. It might be personal, but do you want to talk about it?
What we said today?
Yeah.
I asked John the question. I said, can you ever put I had my phone, I could read you it, but if you could use the term, I can't remember how I wrote it actually.
You were asking that when you refer to yourself, is it always eye making?
That's right.
And I don't remember what I said. So what did I say? No, I want you to. I want you to say it.
You said about. You went on about buying a new car. maybe we should have got the phone.
No. So my. Please.
Well, you'll probably you'll say it a lot better than me. So I understood when you said when I read the difference of having a strong eye. I am referring to myself, whereas in the other eye, I am just explaining what
yep.
I'm doing.
So, everything in the Dhamma comes back to right view and right intention. So it doesn't mean, and you touched on this a little bit, Melanie, too, about just using the word I or referring to yourself. If the intention is pure, it's simply referring to yourself as a reference point. In other words, I got a new car today, and I left the sticker on, and I make sure everybody sees the sticker, and I make sure everybody knows that I got a new car today, rather than just driving my car up and leaving it here. You know, if somebody says, what'd you do today? I might say, oh, I picked up my new car. But in my mind, I'm not using that new car to show everybody how wonderful and successful I am. I just happen to have a new car, just like if I got a new pair of pants or anything else. It's our intention. Everything in the Dhamma is intention. What's my intention in this moment? In fact, it comes down to just that question. Am I trying to continue to establish a self that can't be established in a permanent way in this moment? Or am I simply living my life as my life occurs? You know, that really is the difference. And it all comes back to intention. Now remember, intention relates directly to the Second Noble Truth. Second Noble Truth says that craving originates and clinging perpetuates suffering. Then right intention is the intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging. And we have to look at when I'm using the word I, then, don't we? Am I using this moment to further this thing called an I, this view that I have? Or is it simply a reference point? We talked about this on the retreat, and it's up on the board, too. When a fully awake and fully mature human being who has abandoned the five clinging aggregates, then the self is simply a reference point, period. And so the question might be a reference point where? It's a reference point in your ongoing life. That's all. You're no longer trying to continue to establish itself. In somewhat Zen parlance, you now are yourself. You see the difference?
I think of it like in work. When I'm trying to, when I think I need to defend myself, right? I mean, I'm making a self, I'm bringing a self into it. The more deeply I'm able to concentrate, the more I don't need to defend anything in
yeah.
that situation. And it could be the exact same work situation.
Exactly.
It could be someone coming at me or after me or whatever, and it's a difference of me seeing as a need to defend a self that doesn't exist, or you need to just let that happen and not take on any of it as my own, or I own it, or I'm in it, or I can act like I'm not in it at all.
Yeah.
It's just someone else's blathering, you know? It's a big difference for me.
It's the only difference that's important. You're what you're saying directly relates to what I'm going to talk about in a few minutes, but you're no longer giving birth to another moment of this self that's prone to suffering.
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole point of well, karma and rebirth. We'll talk about that in a few minutes, but thank you for saying that. Everything points back to what is occurring in this moment. And when our life is well integrated with the Eightfold Path, it's the best application of the word integrity, by the way, are we integrated with the Eightfold Path, then each moment holds the potential to continue towards awakening. You know, that's the most important aspect of being present with life as life occurs, so we know what we're doing in this moment. And am I going to continue towards awakening, or am I going to continue to ignore the Eightfold Path and continue ignorance? You know, it's really the only choice we have. Liz, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good to see you too. It's good to be here. Good. So what I've recognized in particular with Anatta most difficult concepts to grasp, and that once you gain a certain level of personal awareness, that to sort of watch yourself in an unskillful manner, defend the self, can feel like falling apart, depending on the construct of your personal ego to begin with. It can feel, you know, like falling apart in a intense vulnerability.
Yep.
So the only thing you can do is to reset and be kind and start the process over.
Yeah. Yep. Be gentle with yourself, always.
So it can, for anyone struggling with this, it's normal, and it can feel like well, I already said it, I'm repeating myself, but it can feel like a crumbling kind of.
Yeah. Feels like annihilation. Because you know,
yeah.
It's all that we know we are. It's all that we think we are. And if I let go of all this, what's left? You know, that's one of those things. And it's not something that we have to take on faith. It's one of those little things that get me a little... It's not faith, because that's the whole point of refuge. We're not taking it on faith. It takes... You can look at it as conviction, because we understand that a human being did just what we're attempting to do, and he showed us the way. And we're fortunate to have a well-focused sangha, too. We have the three jewels, the three refuges of the Dhamma to carry us through. You know.
But if you've also had a glimpse of skillful practice and moments of enlightenment or of awakening where you've experienced non-suffering, that's something that kind of it might be what you might relate to a faith, because you've already seen it happen, you've experienced it. So some people might call that having faith in the system that things will work out or things will be better. You know, you can call it what you want to call it, but if you've seen, if you've had a glimpse, if you feel like you've been motoring along, doing pretty well, being pretty skillful, and then hit a hard patch or whatever. It's a level of understanding that through personal forgiveness or just refocusing, resetting your intention, doing all of those things, that you can sort of get back to. There's always a chance to regroup and get back to.
Yeah. Yeah, and the whole practice supports that regrouping too. You know, even just taking refuge in our meditation practice. You know, twice a day we get to take refuge in just sitting and being quiet and calming our minds, regaining our focus. You know, it's all supportive. So, thank you. Bonnie, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good, thank you. It's good to see you. So, I relate to, of course, a lot of things that everybody has said, but the visual idea of what you talked about of unbinding is pretty significant for me. It's a visual metaphor to undo the crave or the cling.
Yep.
And as someone who has in the past wanted to hold, I mean, just even the nature of a lot of what I do is binding and sewing and holding things together, or as a caretaker, or, you know, so the concept, which is totally, you know, it's like almost opposite, but it's like being counterintuitive, because by doing that, it gives me the ability to have a choice about what I do. And I can't remember Matt's brother's name.
Casey.
What you were saying, that, you know, I really related to what he was saying. Just because I see it, and I know sometimes I know that the right thing to do is to trust that also this behavior didn't really change anything, and you got to the other side, it's going to be okay, you know, sometimes the seeing that, but the idea of keeping that word unbound or unbinding, that it's kind of like I don't have to enter into this contract over and over again, I can let it go, and still like this, like Mel was saying, you know, I am emotional, but, and so it helps to just recognize that it's just what it is, and to, you know, it's going to be there. I'm going to have this natural response, but it's sort of like at that moment of what was talking about, like being vulnerable, it feels like, you know, when you're a child or something, and you have to know, because every time you can unbind or let go, there is a growth that happens, and but it's
hopefully.
Oh well, but it is painful sometimes. So there's this humbling. Oh, that's the other word. There, you know, like to be really humble in some way. And by the more that this happens, the more I feel myself. It's almost like taking myself out of where I used to think I was or where I wanted to be, and it is almost like, you know, an unusual kind of balance. So that what hopefully will surface is what is really on my path. What has my been doing all right? That like what my true home is.
Yeah. And your true home is always in a process of becoming. And when you don't have to defend something that's already become, then you can become what's most important. And that really relates, you use the word humble, that really relates to true humility. Humility means humus, the root of it. It means down to earth. It means we know who we are. And so a fully awakened, fully mature human being is the essence of humility. Think about the Buddha. I mean, really, what is he displaying all the time? What is he expressing? True humility. And there were times when the Buddha himself appeared bigger than life, but he was still humble in that because he had no self that he was trying to project onto the world. You know? And we're developing the same thing. We're developing the ability to not cling to anything in the world and not use that clinging to describe a self, but also when we're free of clinging, we're also free of having the world attach itself to us and other people attach itself to us. We're free. And in a very real... Pardon me?
Can you describe what you just said?
In a very real way, we are able to be fully present with everything, but most importantly with simply our life as life occurs, because we're attached to nothing. As Lao Tzu said, when you understand the impermanence of all things, you let go of everything, including the outer world to be any different than it is. And so that means that the outer world can no longer attach itself to us. We can be much more effective with other people's needs and desires in a realistic way because we understand our own lack of attachment. So even when people, and we all know this, when people are trying to latch themselves onto us, we understand where it's coming from and it just doesn't occur. But we're also able to be much more helpful and much more present. Matt is, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, Matt is probably one of the best examples of this I've ever seen. The way he stays present with people, but does not take on what other people are displaying to him. You want to talk about that a little bit? Or am I putting you on the spot?
No, I think that's...
I don't mind putting you on the spot anyway.
No, yeah. It comes in my experience, it just comes from not needing that person or their experience to be any different than it is. Wherever they are, whatever they're doing, whatever the situation is, you know, I work with people all day long and in a healing context. So healing is a concept. And it includes lots of layers of what it means to be a human being. Emotional, psychological, physical, you know, a lot of layers that what you know, we are. And, you know, people share that with me. And I don't need their story to be any different. You know, if they're emoting or something, I'm not going to attach myself to that activity. I can hold space for it and just facilitate a space for that to move through. Because again, this is all happening in the field of impermanence. So whatever is coming up is gonna pass at some point. Whether it's a feeling, whether it's a strong emotion, whether it's a view of self that has, you know, twisted someone into a shape that now creates pain. These are just things that we see, you know, and it's not my job to fix that either. You know, I just because I'm a healer and or an acupuncturist or an herbalist or whatever, I'm not going to take that on. I'm not going to make it my job to fix somebody. You know, that's I know better than that through this practice, really. Because there's nothing really wrong here. You know, this is just what's happening. This is life as life occurs. So I'm not going to make it wrong. That starts to create tension in me if I start making things wrong. Then I start to get bent out of shape. Because I have to make a story about someone else's thing.
And then it becomes about you.
Right.
And then you can't stay in that healer's place because it...
So that's creating attachments. That's what creating attachments is. That's how it gets laid out.
And they can have...
Right.
They can have external applications and internal applications. So Matt, I think everybody knows, maybe not. Matt is an acupuncturist and a Tai Chi Qigong instructor. Both of those practices are about finding blockages, real blockages, in the body and also in the emotions, and freeing them up. Another word for those blockages is assumptions. The assumptions that we form are the blocks that we create in our own minds to seeing who we really are.
To further that, I mean, you wouldn't be healing if you were helping facilitate attachments. You're
right.
Helping to release attachments. Mm-hmm. And by you releasing your own attachments, other people are able to release their attachments.
Right.
Yep.
Because I'm not attached, then there's nothing clinging. So that's from my experience in work doing healing work for, you know, 17, 18 years now, that's what I've learned is don't attach yourself to it. Don't attach your story to someone else's story. And then, you know, healing will happen maybe.
Maybe it won't.
Yeah.
Thank you. Did that answer your question?
Thank you, Matt.
Well, that was really a wonderful way to describe, you know, the work, but it was something else that you should have
been. You sure?
Yeah, because I can't remember what it was. But that
Thank
was
you.
Beautiful.
It's gotten a little bit late, but not too late. So the last 2 weeks, we, on Dependent Origination and Five Clinging Aggregates, the chapter is called Understanding Not Self. And that's really what it does, doesn't it? I hope you all agree with that. So we've gone through the process beginning in the beginning of the book, learning how to meditate, learning about the four foundations of mindfulness, learning what the Four Noble Truths are, developing an understanding of the Eightfold Path, learning about the three marks of existence, and now the last 2 weeks, understanding not self. And so in a very real way, in the last 2 weeks, you have gained an understanding of the vehicle
that is mentioned in the first noble truth, dukkha, occurs. In the second noble truth, individual craving originates and clinging perpetuates suffering for that vehicle. Once you turn the vehicle off, there's nothing left to suffer. So now this is getting into this week's teaching on karma and rebirth. I'm going to just read a little bit of the article. You're going to read it this week, I hope. But just a couple paragraphs, and then I'll talk briefly about it. Karma and rebirth are conditions arising from ignorance, right? From ignorance through 12 observable links, all manner of suffering arises. The vehicle that has that experience is this five clinging aggregates. And that unfolding experience of ignorance is known as karma, or kama. I wrote kama in the book, K-A-M-M-A, but when I'm speaking, I don't like to use that because it sounds too much like kama rather than karma, so karma. Karma is in no way punishment as a result of arbitrary judgments from a supreme being. That's often the pop use of karma today. If you had a bad day or something bad happened to you, oh, you got bad karma. It's like there's a cloud over your head. It's got nothing to do with karma. Karma is not the consequences from a vague, independent, moral, ethical, spiritual system, which is really how it's almost always portrayed. Karma is not a condition imposed on you. You alone are the cause of your karma, and you alone are the cause of rebirth. Karma should not be viewed simply as what is unfolding in your life. Karma is the present unfolding of past intentional actions, moderated by your present state of understanding and quality of mindfulness. As your present state of mindfulness and understanding animate your current actions are moderating the effects of past actions. Everybody got that?
No.
So I'll repeat it. Karma is the present moment unfolding. What's going on right here, right now in our life, including right here in this room. Present unfolding of past intentional actions moderated by the present level of your mindfulness. What you want, and I'm talking about mindfulness in the sense of the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. So using this example of right here in this room, if you walked in here and you had no understanding about what we were talking about and you weren't participating in a course or had some background in this, and you listened to what I just said, it would be complete nonsense, wouldn't it? But because you have the right frame of reference, you can start making useful understanding of the teaching tonight. You're moderating what's occurring in this moment based on your level of mindfulness. So karma, again, is not punishment. It's not just a result of past actions. It's really how we're experiencing the results of past actions. And that's what I'm referring to. The measure of our refined mindfulness has more to do with the experience of karma than past actions. So everything we've ever done in our life has brought us here to this point right now.
So John, is this to have an understanding that I'm probably going to answer my own question, but so explaining karma this way is so that you can, through skilled through your skillful knowledge of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, you can tamper. Is that the right word? You can
temper. Temper, yes.
Temper your karma by living in a more skillful way.
Exactly.
Okay.
That's it. That's exactly it. And that's a good word to use, temper.
No, I'm not sure I have it. Before you forget it. I can listen to it again on tape.
Right. What's most important about that, and it points to the potential of each moment, is in this moment I'm experiencing my karma. With the right mindfulness that I've developed through the Eightfold Path, I can now use the present situation and turn my mind and my actions towards awakening. Or I can continue ignorance, ignore the teachings, ignore what's obvious, and continue karma going in a way that's only going to prove to be more hurtful.
Mm-hmm. Even if it's just sort of beating yourself up about the coming to the confronting your past unskillful behavior.
Yes. By judging yourself harshly.
By judging yourself harshly.
Yep.
Continuing
yourself. That is an action that directly creates more karma in your life. Any harsh judgment we make of ourselves, and that often occurs while we're developing the Buddhist teachings. We start judging ourselves for making unskillful decisions in the past, or even recognizing that, well, yeah, I do have to awaken. Instead of being, that's where joy is so important in the Dhamma. You know, one of the Brahma Viharas, recognizing that we have a way out. I mean, this is still one of the most incredible realizations I've ever had, that a human being taught this 2,600 years ago, and those same teachings are still here today. They're a little bit more difficult to find than they were 2,600 years ago, but they're still here today. And we all have a mind. I want to talk about this in a personal way, and not that I have any kind of special type of mind. I have an ordinary mind, but that ordinary mind can understand the Dharma well enough that I can make use Dharma well enough to use it. I can bring my karma to cessation. And we all can. And that leads to the second aspect of karma and rebirth, which is another thing that's often misunderstood. The Buddha's not talking about future births, although there's a component of that in here, but it's really not important. The important understanding of karma and rebirth is, what are we going to give birth to in the next moment? And if we understand what we've developed so far, including the three marks of existence, we recognize that even our karmic situation right now is rooted in impermanence. And if it's less than satisfactory, it's because of a misunderstanding of the second mark of existence, anatta. We don't understand who we are, and so we're creating suffering. That karma can continue, or we can fully integrate and fully develop the Eightfold Path and bring karma to cessation. And once we've done that, then there is no possibility of giving birth to another moment that's prone to confusion, delusion, and suffering. And that's the most important teaching on rebirth. It's not that we'll do enough good acts that, you know, I'll start developing future more pleasant births. And at some point, if you know, the way it's often presented, if we keep gaining merit and keep doing a lot of the right things and saying the right chants and doing all the right stuff, endless lifetimes from now will be granted awakening. Well, I followed that path for a long, long time, and I didn't really understand why I was so uneasy with it, because I was just following along, until I realized that's ridiculous. The Buddha taught a path for human beings to awaken in this lifetime by recognizing what they're giving birth to in each moment. That's where that concentration comes in. That's the useful teaching on karma and rebirth. So as you read the, again, it's gotten a little bit late. As you read this, remember to read karma and rebirth in the context of what you've learned so far and in the context of developing understanding of suffering. Because any other take on karma and rebirth doesn't apply to what the Buddha's trying to develop here, what we're trying to develop. An understanding of suffering and understanding of our own contributions to suffering, which is karma. As we develop a well-concentrated mind and are able to maintain that refined mindfulness, we can start inclining our minds and inclining our karma towards awakening, towards no longer giving birth to a moment that is rooted in confusion, delusion, and suffering, a moment that's rooted in ignorance. When we say when I read the Karaniya Metta Sutta, that last line, will no longer be born again into this world. It doesn't mean that we're going to die if we fully develop metta. It means we will no longer give birth to another moment that includes this five clinging aggregate self, that self that is prone to suffering. When the Buddha awakened, he said a few things. He touched the earth, his hand was like, he touched the earth with his right hand, and he said the integrated, it's often written, the holy life has been lived. But I think a more appropriate word is the integrated life has been lived. There is nothing more for me in this world, or I will not be born again into this world. He's not talking about future rebirths. He's talking about he is no longer capable of establishing a confused, deluded self in this world anymore. The integrated life has been lived. There is nothing further for me in this world. some people will say that does point to annihilation. He said that when he was 36 years old and he lived 45 more years. So he's certainly not talking about annihilation. He's talking about eye-making, the whole point of the Dhamma. There's nothing further for us in this world. So any questions about this? Yes, Lorna.
Your description of karma, when you pass life up to this present in the present context of your mind right now, isn't that all eye making?
Yes.
Looking at yourself, I have done this. You're not
continuing eye making by simply looking at what's occurring. Again, what's your intention? Your intention in this context is to develop the Dhamma. So just to look at it from that right view and right intention is just a realistic view. Karma is a present moment unfolding of past intentional acts modified or moderated by the present level of mindfulness. If we have no mindfulness as it relates to the Eightfold Path, then we're just going to continue following the same momentum that our conditioned thinking will carry us towards. But because we've developed a way to interrupt our conditioned thinking through this practice, then we can change the direction of our karma. And again, getting back to that question that you emailed me earlier, the Buddha, when he awakened, he never referred to himself as a Buddha. What he did say was, I am the Tathagata. He used a word, a self-referential word, but without any self-referential intent behind it. He was simply pointing out, using that word Tathagata, is pointing out that the only difference between me and other arahants, awakened human being, is I'm the guy that figured it out. I'm the first one. That's what it means. But that's only now you see that it's just a point of reference.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Okay, the difference.
Rather than,
yeah.
I'm the guy, I am the Buddha, I'm the awakened one.
It's just a point of reference.
Just a point of reference. I'm the guy that figured it out.
Okay.
So yeah, and it's such an important point to understand that.
It's not awakened as existence, it's just what it is.
It's just what it is. Again, and it's such a great discussion. This isn't about annihilation. It's about seeing reality. Seeing what we really are. You know, again, this is not about annihilation of self, or there's no such thing as a self. When the Buddha used the term anatta, he was simply using that term to say what you think of yourself. Your views of yourself don't constitute a self. They don't arise up to a self. It's not a self. Let go of the views. Same thing of five clinging aggregates. Let go of the views. The aggregates fall apart. What's left? This is what's left. Fully awakened, fully mature human being. Able to interact with the world and what occurs by being completely mindfully present. That's where life really begins. That's where the real meaning in life is in being present. But not present in a static way. In other words, not trying to fix ourselves into this moment. There's no such thing as the present moment. But there is an incredible experience of being in our own life as our life unfolds, without the need for it to be any different, without clinging to views that something should be different than it is. Being at peace with what's occurring. Again, any questions? Okay, so... so, yeah, what a dramatic class. We'll do meta in just a second. So you'll read this chapter on karma and rebirth. We're getting right to the end. And we'll discuss it next week. And just try to keep it in mind that, again, these teachings are all in the context of the Four Noble Truths. Nothing's taken outside of that. They all relate back to those teachings. The only other announcement is our retreat's coming up, May 11th or 14th. I think there's one more single room and maybe two more quad rooms for both men and women, but there's plenty of double rooms. But if you're coming, the sooner you can register, the better it is for me. We'll finish with metta. The Buddha's words on metta. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future, or that may have arisen from our talk tonight. And metta is both an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path and an expression of a fully awakened, fully mature human being. These are the Buddha's words from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is no longer born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace. Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.